Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening.
I'm Will Campion and co-founder of the Money Maze podcast. And we're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is also a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker Bremont.
Today we're going to talk US equities. Overvalued? Overloved? Overallocated? Is it the time to reduce and take chips off the table? Or is that narrative flawed? Well, the man across the table from me today, recently landed from Birmingham, Alabama, and whose firm has achieved stellar long-term investment returns, is already straining at the leash to counter that argument. So, C.T. Fitzpatrick, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you, Simon. It's a pleasure to be here tonight.
We're going to talk about U.S. equities, but I just want to take a few steps back. Because CT, you were brought up in Alabama, and I'd just like to know what a Southern upbringing was like and what stands out most in your mind.
Well, it wasn't completely unlike what I imagine an upbringing here in the UK would be like. We have a lot of similar values. Manners are very important. I'm sitting here in London, and I feel very much at home.
That's great. And I note, as I did my research ahead of this, that you have a undergraduate degree from the University of Alabama and an MBA from Vanderbilt. And I wonder if you just tell me how you thought about choices of subject and why you felt an MBA was important.
I very much knew what I wanted to do at a very young age. I started reading the Wall Street Journal when I was about 14 years old, and I read it to this day. And I wanted to go to the University of Alabama because they have a very good accounting program. I wanted to major in finance so that I could get into investment. So I took a lot of accounting along with my finance work, minored in English, which I found very helpful. And I have a lot of respect for a liberal arts education. I was just too impatient and wanted to start working. So I just didn't have the patience to get a liberal arts education and then have to have an interim before I could get out into the working world.
So impatience is not a helpful asset necessarily in investing. We're going to talk about that and how that may or may not have changed over time. But where did the MBA come in?
Yeah, so I was very fortunate just in terms of timing. I graduated in the mid-80s. Ronald Reagan was president at the time. Margaret Thatcher was in charge over here, and the economy was booming. Wall Street was booming, and I wanted to get into investment management, doing what I'm doing right now, but I had an opportunity to join Merrill Lynch Capital Markets and their investment banking division in New York. And I talked to a bunch of people who I respected a lot, and they said, look, you should really go take this job. This is not exactly what you want to do, but it's similar enough to what you want to do. You'll learn an awful lot. And then if you desire, you can go to graduate school, get an MBA, and transition into money management. And that's exactly what I did.
So was your first job at Southeastern Asset Management after that, after the MBA?
Well, that was my first permanent job. I'd had some internships and had worked full-time in investment banking, but my first full-time job with a money manager out of graduate school was with Southeastern Asset Management, yes.
So now let's talk a little bit about Southeastern Asset Management, because you spent 17 years there as a principal and portfolio manager and built a really impressive track record. But you had to learn your craft. Tell me a little bit about what you did and how you did it.
Yeah, well, it was just a real honor to be a part of that team. I was able to get a lot of responsibility, became a partner pretty early on. I became a real estate expert and ran a real estate fund for almost a decade because we were just finding so much value in real estate at the time that we wanted to have a dedicated fund for that. So I started out as a journalist. I ended up being a real estate expert and then ended up being a journalist again. We closed our real estate fund in the early 2000s. In hindsight, way too early. We'll talk about some things later, but I think sometimes value investors can be too early to exit positions, and we'll talk more about that later perhaps. But I started as a journalist, became a real estate expert, ended as a journalist, and then left to start Vulcan Value Partners.
Yes, well, I think it might have been attributed to one of the Rothschild partners that tops and bottoms are unattainable. So we always remember we should leave something on the table for the next investor. But 17 years and you decide to establish Vulcan Value Partners. Now, a lot of listeners work at asset management firms. They think about that transition. It's become more difficult, I think, because of certainly here in Europe, regulatory requirements. But just explain to me what the motivation was and also what your vision was.
So I think that people who are passionate about what they do really try to get better and better at it. They think about it all the time. And it's not that your philosophy will necessarily change, but the execution of that philosophy will change. So one of the things that we say at Vulcan is that we follow principles, not rules. Principles are unchanging, but rules are too constricting. They're too narrow. And following the principles of value investing, I came to believe that value stability was really important, that it was equally as important as the discount itself. And I came to that conclusion by trial and error, by asking myself on a personal level, how can I do a better job? Because we're all human, we all make mistakes. And there were certain names over the course of my career that I was responsible for, most of which worked out really well, but a few did not. And I said, go back and examine that. What caused that? And it wasn't that the valuation was wrong at the time or that it wasn't discounted. It's that the value itself was not stable. And I tracked every mistake that I was responsible for back to that and felt so strongly about it that I wanted to start Vulcan Value Partners to focus on value stability in addition to the margin of safety. Said another way, I wanted us to have a sustainable margin of safety. And I think that dual discipline is really what Vulcan is all about. Very, very important to our investment process. And again, I felt so strongly about it that I decided to start Vulcan.
So Vulcan Value Partners, based in Birmingham, Alabama, you manage over $20 billion. You have, I think, 65 members of staff, and you're only in Alabama, which is interesting, and we'll come back to the idea of managing the investment process and managing the business a little later on. Was there an advantage in having a clean sheet of paper when you leave a firm like Southeastern, however good it was?
Yeah, that is a really profound question, and it is absolutely a very powerful asset, and it is a one-time asset. It is a wasting asset. You only get it once, and it erodes. So most startups fail. The odds are stacked against them, but that one asset that you just mentioned is a key asset, and we try to exploit it to the fullest. And one of the things we did, very busy getting everything ready to go, but we stopped and said, we're going to take some time off and we're going to distill our common values. What is it we're trying to do? What are we trying to accomplish? And we're going to summarize all that into the key values that unite us, all of the people who were taking this huge risk to start Vulcan. And we ended up with what are our Vulcan values, and they are on our website, featured prominently. They're featured prominently in all our materials. We talk to our employees about our Vulcan values. It's part of the interview process. If you're not comfortable with these values, you probably wouldn't want to be here. And we use those values to guide our strategic plan. Whenever we can't figure out what to do, we always stop and go back to our values. And so we use that blank piece of paper to create that foundation. And really, the company has been built on top of the foundation of those values.
So let's talk about the investment process. It's very clear, looking at your commentaries and materials on your portfolio, that you are very specific in the companies that you are seeking to invest in. And by definition, any fund that has between 20 and 40 names, and a lot of the time 20 to 30, is concentrated by general standards, but it's also very specific. And you talk a lot about good businesses. And that, of course, suffers potentially from being quite subjective. Although I think you have, particularly with the research and the technology, that you have tried to quantify that. So what I'd like to really understand from you is how you define a good business.
For us, a good business is a company who has a stable value. That's really our definition. What kind of characteristics does a stable value company have? Well, first and foremost, it has to produce free cash flow. You can think about a stock as a bond that grows. And if the bond, say, declines to 95% of par from 100% of par because interest rates have gone up, well, you've lost 5%. However, if the bond paid an 8% coupon, you'd still have 103. So your value is inherently more stable if you produce free cash flow than if you consume it. And some companies have to consume cash to grow. They have unstable values. They can grow really fast. The values can grow fast. But the values are inherently unstable. Another thing we look for are companies that have really strong balance sheets. Now, it's not just the absolute level of debt that a company might have, but it's how the debt is structured. And what is the debt in relation to the free cash flow? Having said that, most of our companies have net cash on the balance sheet, very inefficient balance sheets. But if you have a company that has a free cash flow coupon and has net cash on the balance sheet, it's going to have a stable value. Compare that to, say, a bank that might be levered 20 to 1, $20 of liabilities for every dollar of equity. And in order to grow, it can't produce free cash flow. It has to reinvest in its balance sheet to grow. If you're wrong by just a little bit on the value of that company's assets, and you think about things like the financial crisis and how unstable those asset values can be against that leverage, that is the anti-Vulcan stock. Those companies have inherently unstable values, where ours have, if nothing else, we'll get the cash on the balance sheet right. And the free cash flow coupon lends value stability. So from a quantitative point of view, I just gave you the opposite of what we want and the bullseye of what we want. And even that's not enough. Qualitatively, it's great to say, I'd love to have this business that generates free cash flow. Everybody would like to produce free cash flow, only some businesses can. Well, why are you able to do that? Well, you have to have some kind of competitive advantage that is sustainable that will allow you to produce free cash flow. So from a qualitative point of view, we want to identify those competitive advantages. There might be multiple advantages. And we want to make sure they are sustainable over our long-term time horizon, and we want to make sure we understand them. And even that's not enough. We then want to see that their competitive advantages are getting stronger. Their competitive position is getting stronger, not weaker. When you get down to that level of all these things we want, there are not a lot of businesses in the world that qualify at Vulcan. We estimate we have uncovered approximately 500 companies from around the world that have value stability, and we will only invest in those 500. There can be a lot of other things that look statistically cheap, very interesting if you're just interested in valuation only, but we have a dual discipline. We're just as disciplined about the types of businesses that we will invest in as we are the discount that we demand. And so there's only just a small number of businesses out of the entire investable universe available to us that meet our value stability standards.
So let me just press you on that notion of the discount to fair value and help me understand exactly how you quantify that.
At the end of the day, it's a longhand discounted cash flow calculation. You can take shortcuts with multiples and do some math, and you can merge the two, and that's fun to do. But at the end of the day, it's a longhand discounted cash flow evaluation.
And let's just circle back to debt? Because although there are companies that you own, as you said, that have net cash, there will be companies that are indebted. And debt's been easy, cheap. It's been arguably mispriced, courtesy of all this central bank gaming of the system, with consequences that we may yet be aware of. But in a way, this rush to make so-called efficient balance sheets has been exposed during COVID and may yet be exposed again. So tell me how you think about the right levels of debt and where you're comfortable with debt.
Again, the structure is very important. You can have two companies with identical amounts of debt, and one company might have a lot of short-term maturities coming due. They might have a line of credit that can be called by the banks on relatively short notice. And another company might have even more debt or the same amount of debt, but it's very intelligently structured, and there are very few maturities coming due anytime soon. And the free cash flow coupon, even in a recession, more than covers the maturities coming due. That kind of balance sheet looks a lot less risky to us than one that has a lot of short-term obligations coming due. Having said that, we're not crazy about debt in general, and most of our companies have net cash, which they use strategically to give them flexibility to protect and enhance their competitive advantages.
So these sorts of businesses that you identify and you own have, of course, the moat that Warren Buffett has written about and has made so important in his process. So there's some similarities here, but I wonder how you think your approach differs from Warren Buffett.
Warren Buffett has been so generous in sharing not only what he thinks at the moment, but his evolution as an investor. And I really think that people can learn more about following his evolution than to really look at what he says at a point in time, because he changes his mind over time, which I think is very interesting. But he does stay true to the principles. And the idea of having a margin of safety is so important. When we look at the businesses that Mr. Buffett owns and we look at the businesses that we own, while he owns some really great businesses, I think our businesses are more competitively entrenched. We place more emphasis on value stability. Now, he does place emphasis on value stability. It's just how important is that to you? And to us, we have a very, very high bar.
So let's just talk about identification of ideas. You've got a research engine that is sitting there in your office that you have developed culturally along the lines that you feel are important. Just talk me through how an idea is initiated.
We get a lot of ideas from following the companies that we own, and we are always paranoid about competitive threats to the companies we own. So when we identify one of those competitive threats, well, guess what? That might be the next company that we want to include in our value stable companies. By the way, we call that our MVP list. And we get a lot of ideas simply by following the companies we own.
Those of us who have been around long enough can remember the great Nifty 50s, the Kodak, the Xeroxes, the IBMs. They were all upheld as being the go-to must-own glory stocks. And as we know, many of them withered, some perished. Tell me about how you process and think about losing that edge.
I think one of the things about our company is that growth is one part of the valuation process. All else being equal, a company growing faster is worth more than a company that's growing slower. All else being equal, key statement. Companies that grow their values rapidly, if they're priced at a level that implies that they can grow at that rate for an unrealistically long period of time, or they're growing at, say, 10% plus, but they're priced like they're growing at 20% plus. If you pay too much for a great business, you have the opposite of a margin of safety, and they're very, very risky. And that's what happened to the Nifty 50. They were great businesses. Nothing wrong with the businesses themselves back then. A lot of them evolved and changed, but people simply paid too much for them. And so they ended up taking on a lot of risk. What we want to do is own businesses with those kind of characteristics with a discount.
One of the things that you mentioned earlier on was you were in a hurry as a youngster and got into this business. And I listened to a podcast recording that you'd done with Columbia University about the Graham and Dodds investment approach. And the word temperament is brought up. And we've had a lot of thoughtful guests on the Money Maze podcast, but Nikolai Tangen and Luba Nicolina and Bo Knudsen all recently talked about their investment approaches and the disciplines. And I wondered how you would describe your temperament.
I'm very fortunate to be partners with the people that I work with. This temperament really permeates our company. And you have to go back to periods of stress, periods of volatility, and how do you react to those periods? And if you get really stressed out because the market's going down a lot, or a particular stock that you own is going down a lot, you're probably not a good fit for Vulcan Value Partners. We can really differentiate between price and value. And we love to see stock price volatility because we know our values are inherently stable. So with stable values and falling stock prices, when a lot of people are panicking and the headlines are scary, like during the beginning of the pandemic, we're like kids in a candy store. We see that as opportunity. It makes us happy. It's actually kind of joyful, really. That's when we really are able to add value in periods of volatility. So when the world is just calm and easy and everybody's happy, we're kind of in a bad mood. And when things get kind of scary out there, we're not scared because we know the underlying values of the businesses we own. We know they're stable. And so we see stock price volatility as opportunity. That is a mindset, and that comes from our dual discipline. If we were just looking for cheap stocks, we wouldn't have value stability. We'd be a lot more stressed out. But that dual discipline really keeps us in a temperament that allows us to be very calm when other people are not calm.
Yes, I think it was Oscar Wilde who said that it's a cynic and knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. And you indeed make a good point about value, and that ultimately the return is a function of the price paid at acquisition. I'd love, CT, for you to give me an example of one of the companies in your portfolio that you think satisfies a lot of those characteristics we've been talking about.
I'm going to mention a company that we've owned for quite a long time. We purchased this during the financial crisis, and it was really differentiated. I gave that example earlier in our conversation about what we look for versus what we don't. So during the financial crisis, we bought MasterCard at an enormous discount to our estimate of intrinsic value at the time. With the benefit of hindsight, and we look at what actually has happened in the decade plus that we've owned MasterCard, if we had known that and we could have put those numbers of what they actually did into our model back when we bought it, our value was way too conservative. MasterCard was even cheaper than we thought it was when we bought it. But by our math, we thought we were buying MasterCard at approximately 60 cents on the dollar in the fall of 2008. Lehman Brothers was going bankrupt, J.P. Morgan was in trouble, RBS was in trouble, and MasterCard, which some people classify as a financial services company, some people classify as a technology company, but it's caught up in that financial services industry. Everybody wanted to get out of anything that had financial on it. And so they were throwing the baby out with the bathwater. So unlike a highly leveraged bank that has to reinvest their free cash flow in order to grow, MasterCard had net cash on its balance sheet. All of its earnings were in cash. And the worst thing that could happen to it is that cyclically, as we're going into a great financial crisis recession, people are going to slow down spending for a little while, and their earnings are going to go down a little bit, not much. And meanwhile, we get the free cash flow coupon. So very stable value. The stock is plunging. It gave us an opportunity to buy one of the best businesses in the world at a large discount. Now, the second part of that story is that after we paid 60 cents of the dollar for it, they actually didn't have earnings going down. Somehow, their earnings actually went up. And so our value was too conservative. Our value's up. The stock has gone down again. This is now into the early part of 2009, and the market had another down leg. And we bought MasterCard at 40 cents on the dollar, and it became one of the largest positions in our portfolio. I'd have to go back and check the exact numbers, but it was up something like 100% in 2009, and it was still discounted because when you start at 40 and the value continues to grow, and the value started growing very, very nicely as the economy started to recover, it was still discounted. Fortunately, we still own it today, and it's been one of our best long-term investments.
Now, there will be occasions where you've owned a company for a very long time, and it's done what you wanted, but just explain to me, what are the flags that are raised as it becomes less compelling and other names compete for a position in the portfolio?
Well, when you begin to see a company's competitive position erode, we really want to be ahead of that, and we really want to exit that company before you start to see it in the financials. And that's one thing. That doesn't happen too often to us. Our companies are so strong, they tend to get stronger over time, but it does happen occasionally. What happens more often is that a company like MasterCard or some other company we might own, price goes up more than value, and the price to value ratio becomes less attractive. There's less of a margin of safety, and we size our positions according to discount. So if something that is more discounted, we'd want it to be a larger weight in the portfolio. Something that is less discounted, we want it to be a smaller weight in the portfolio. And so our position sizes will change over time. I believe MasterCard got to be around 8% of our portfolio back in 2009. And it's possible it's been as low as 4. I think it's been down to 2. I'll have to check with our compliance department. But its weight has fluctuated depending on value growth compared to stock price growth. In fact, at the time we bought MasterCard, it was materially cheaper than Visa. If you had actually just taken Visa's metrics and applied them to MasterCard, you pretty much would have gotten our value back in 2008. Fast forward a few years, and the Dodd-Frank legislation was coming out, and MasterCard was going to benefit from that legislation, and at the margin, it would hurt Visa. Now, the only thing that happened to Visa is it just wasn't going to grow quite as fast as it would have otherwise, but the stock plummeted. Because MasterCard was benefiting from the legislation, its stock price went up a lot. Its value was growing, but not as much as the stock price. We actually trimmed our position in MasterCard and bought Visa and added it to the portfolio during that time period. That's an example of how we size positions and what would cause us to move out of one name and into another.
So I want to return to where I started, which is that I know you have written and you're very excited about the companies that you own and the valuations that you're finding and securing, but from a top-down perspective, looking at the numbers, the US is an incredibly expensive stock market. Now, you have got operating margins in the US at record highs. You've got rising material costs and freight prices, accelerating wages, probably higher tax rates. You've got higher interest rates probably on the horizon, all of which are headwinds. At the time when, if you look at the EV/EBITDA of the US market, it's 40% higher than at the height of the 2000 dot-com bubble. So just help me understand how we reconcile those two positions.
There are a couple of things. One, we don't own the market. There's a concept called active share that I'm sure you and a lot of your listeners are familiar with, and it's basically how much you look like the market. And if you have an active share of 99, you look nothing like the market. Your portfolio is 99% different. Our portfolio is around 99. So there are just entire sectors or industries that we would never own at any price because they don't have stable values. So when we talk about broad market statistics like that, there are a lot of companies that we look at we wouldn't own at any price. So we have no opinion about their valuation because we just don't want to waste our time valuing them. But of our MVP companies that we would like to own, I can tell you that most of our MVP list is overvalued most of the time. And so it is very possible that the U.S. market is overvalued and all the things that you talked about are probably going to happen and probably not be great for the market in general, but we don't own the market. And our companies have pricing power. History would show that we're pretty good at valuation. Whenever there are buyouts and comparables, they tend to confirm and generally exceed the valuations that we're using for our own companies. So we do think we have them at a large discount, and we know that our companies are getting more competitively entrenched. And this year that just ended will be the year that we had better value growth in our portfolios than in any year in our firm's history. That is to say that if you look at the values of the businesses that we had at the beginning of the year and you compare them to our updated values at the end of the year for the entire portfolio, it's going to be the greatest in our firm's history. So with very strong value growth, with a demonstrated discount, I don't really care what happens to the U.S. market. And just one more thing about that, given how we operate, we would love to see a market crash. We would love to see the U.S. market go down because with stable value companies and lower prices, it gives us more long-run opportunity.
So therein lies the great debate, I suppose, between the top-down view and the bottom-up view, and you're very clear, and thank you for that. But there are presumably times, and COVID's arrival might be one of them, where the bearish calls might be overwhelming and you might be distracted because of the unknowns into having your thesis challenged. Just tell me, when COVID came along, how you processed it.
So there were really three stages we went through. Stage one was stress test all of our companies. And we experienced what we have described, and we actually wrote in our annual letter to our clients, as a greater than 3 standard deviation event. And I think it's worth repeating, a 3 standard deviation covers more than 99% of the time. So that's not a light statement. Just to remember the math on that. So our companies could get through virtually anything, but a greater than 3 standard deviation event is tail risk. And so we discovered a couple, just a couple out of 30 names back in the day that we owned going into the crisis, of companies that we thought could not withstand a greater than 3 standard deviation event. And it was all because of their balance sheets. And it was not necessarily the level of debt, but it was how that debt was structured. Now, they were probably going to be okay. They could probably get through it. But we couldn't say it with certainty like we could for the companies that had net cash on their balance sheet. So we exited those businesses. That was step one. We used the proceeds to buy fantastic businesses because everything was on sale. And we also sold, back to our earlier example, companies whose stock prices had held up better and whose values were stable. They were higher price to value ratio of stocks. So we were selling 80 cent dollars to buy 40 cent dollars. And we drove the weighted average price to value ratio of the entire portfolio down into the low 50s, right around 50% through that process. So stage one, stage two. Stage three, we pretty quickly realized that COVID was going to cause some companies' competitive advantages to become even better, and it was really going to hurt the business models of other businesses, some of which were already struggling. So we said, we really can't improve our price-to-value ratios anymore. Everything's so discounted. But we can move the portfolio into companies that are going to become stronger, become more competitively entrenched in a post-COVID world. Their value growth should be stronger or above average because of what's happened. And that turned out to be a really, really good decision. Sitting here today after that, we have had, as I mentioned earlier, extraordinary value growth. We could not model how fast our values are growing. And our companies have become more competitively entrenched. They're massively benefiting from the changes that are taking place in people's behaviors and in the economy as a result of COVID. And our prices have gone up. Our performance has been good. That's the numerator. The denominator is the underlying value of the businesses themselves. So our price-to-value ratios, not the markets, but ours, remain extremely attractive if we're having this conversation here tonight.
So you alluded to the identification of a couple of weaker cards in your hand that you had chose to act on, and the investment business is about learning from mistakes, improving processes, and I wonder what you took from that that maybe changed your research approach.
Well, really, we had learned lessons from earlier mistakes we had made, and one of the things that we have learned is that there's a real tension between being patient and taking a long-term view and not just being like Mr. Market, being emotional and up one day and down the next, and being too patient when the assumptions that you're using to value the business don't come through. And we have learned to move a lot quicker with that. And when the situation changes, we're trying to change quicker. And those learnings from earlier mistakes, and I'll mention one, Fossil, which we could get into it. It's a long story, but we were just too patient with Fossil. And we should have gotten out of that a lot earlier than we did. Taking that learning and applying it to the pandemic enabled us to move much, much faster. And I think that that's an example of better execution of our principles, not changing the principles, but just living into them better.
Now, when I look at your portfolio and I understand your approach, you can have up to 30% in non-US companies. And I think you might be close to that 30% right now. And I note, as I look at the names, there's a preponderance of UK companies. And we've talked about that on the podcast because I'm sympathetic to that. I note no Chinese companies. And there we have some dominant companies that are leading players in those markets whose valuations, at least at standard valuation levels, look pretty attractive. how do you think about those Chinese companies that must appear on your screens?
Our process, our emphasis on value stability, a byproduct of that is it tends to create a portfolio, and our MVP list is full of companies that tend to look very good from an ESG perspective. And we have found incorporating ESG into the work that we're doing explicitly is another very powerful part of our toolkit. It's just allowing us to execute better and identify risks that might not be as obvious if you're not going through those lenses. Well, how about the G? That's a big part of it. And to be very blunt, China has terrible corporate governance. And your business partner oftentimes is the Chinese government. There are things called variable interest entities that are very opaque, arcane legal structures whereby foreign investors can own Chinese stocks. And it's not really clear what you own. If you really peel back the onion, it's possible that you don't have the legal right to the shares that you have bought. Well, that is just terrible corporate governance. And so while there are some very good businesses in China, and we would love to own them, we've got to have the G as well. And so our discipline just will simply not allow us to buy Chinese stocks at this moment. The world could change. I hope it does change. But right now, China is just red line for us.
That is very clear. So thank you. Now, you have grown a very successful business. And one of the challenges, of course, in the growth of an asset management business is the principal often gets pulled away from the managing money to the managing the people, managing the process, all those distractions. How have you fought that pull?
Thank you for that question. It's really important. And I'm just really, really fortunate to have some amazing business partners. Our president, Adam McLean, is the first employee that I hired when we started Vulcan. He's been there since the very earliest days. Our COO, Richard Davis, works closely with Adam, and we have a lot of really great department heads. I'm the head of research, of course, but we have other department heads running different parts of our company, and they all work together and just do a fabulous job running the day-to-day operations, which allows me to focus 90%+ of my time on the investments. And the time that I don't spend on it, basically, it's just Richard and Adam telling me the problems they've identified and all the solutions they have. And 90% of the time, I say, great job, guys. Thank you so much. Every now and then, I have to get involved in something, but it's very rare.
So in running the research process engine, which is, of course, everything, is I understand that you've been thinking a little bit about how technology, even AI, might help you in the future. So just give me a sense of how you're thinking about the evolution of research.
We have an investment in a company called NVIDIA, and that is just a whole nother long story itself. But NVIDIA is benefiting greatly from AI. They make GPUs, which is one of the key pieces of hardware you need, and also has a lot of software in it as well, to advance artificial intelligence. And we learned a lot about artificial intelligence from studying NVIDIA and also Oracle, which we've owned in the past as well. That gave us an early insight that we could benefit from AI. And we started experimenting with it and building our own system. And we kept having tests. And every time we had a test, we passed the test with flying colors. And basically, what we're using it for is to supplement our human analyst, and to vastly improve our productivity. We can look at virtually any company in the world, tear it apart, and basically we've trained it to say, here's our MVP list. We like these kind of businesses with these characteristics. Go find us something else out there that we don't have the hours in the day to do, and find us something that looks like the stuff that we already own. And we found some really great names that we would not have found otherwise by doing that.
So one of the things we haven't talked about for a while on the Money Maze podcast is what's happening to the sell side, the brokerage community that was or did hold the balance of power 25 years ago, whereas the asset management industry really is now, in my opinion, you know, dictating terms. How do you operate with the research community on the sell side? Do you find them too short term? How do you think that they help you, or do they not help you in your research process?
There are some really smart people on the sell side. And some of them really know the companies they follow very, very well. They have a couple of problems. One, they tend to be very industry specific, and they know an awful lot about that company they follow or the companies within that industry, but they kind of have blinders on because there's a lot going on outside of that industry. So from a knowledge base, they can be helpful, but they have a second problem, and that is their compensation structure. They are rewarded with annual bonuses based upon how things go in the short run, and they're always putting out buys, sells, and holds based upon short-run factors. And we have had so many instances where we have bought these fabulous businesses because they have an earnings slowdown or maybe even a negative earnings comparison. And a lot of the people who are following it say, gee, don't buy such and such because they have poor earnings visibility for the next 12 months. Well, we are looking at it with our longhand discounted cash flow metrics, and we factor that in, and it's a blip. Makes virtually no difference to the value whatsoever, but the stock price has gone down quite a bit. So we really kind of take the opposite side of the sell side. Often that doesn't mean they're not smart people or good people. It just means that their incentives are short term. Our incentives are long term.
So that's a nice point to come back to the companies you look at and just ask you, particularly around compensation of senior executives, what are the behaviors that make you uncomfortable?
We really hate to see high salaries and low stock ownership. That really bothers us. We like to see substantial equity ownership by our management teams, and we like to see it throughout the management team, not just with one individual. So when we see a lot of ownership in the management team and relatively low compensation levels compared to that ownership, that's a good sign for us.
I'd like to ask you some general questions, if I may. Is there a company that you have wanted to own but was never cheap enough on your criteria to be able to own?
Over the course of my career, I've been doing this for so long, most of the businesses that I've really wanted to own have come our way at one time or another. So that's a really happy statement to be able to make. So I really can't think of a name. I've been doing this for about 30 years now that comes to mind.
And have you, on your journey, had one or two investment heroes that you have studied particularly?
There are several, and there are quite a number, but two that I think deserve special mention are Bill Ruane and John Templeton, Sir John Templeton. And if you look at our Vulcan values, they have been inspired by those two gentlemen. We really admire not just their investment process, their contrarian nature, their thoughtfulness, but also who they were as people. They were very generous, very giving people, very thoughtful people. Their organizations had great cultures. There's so many, but those are two that really come to mind.
And more personally, as you've gone through this journey of being an investor, what are the most difficult challenges you've had to overcome?
Even though I have a lot of help from Adam and from Richard and other people in our company, I have had to learn how to become more of a leader than just simply an investor. And you can't do this by yourself. You really have to have a great team around you. You have to have a great culture. And I think when I started doing this, I was a pretty good investor, but probably not the best leader that I could be. I've learned an awful lot about leadership since we started Vulcan, and I hope that I'm doing a better job today than I was when we first started.
And we have quite a lot of students and young people who listen to this podcast around the world. And I just wonder what advice you might have to a young person thinking about getting into the asset management business.
Well, I'd say start by reading Graham and Dodd. That's all important. Read Mr. Buffett. The Intelligent Investor is a must read for everybody who wants to get into this business. And if that appeals to you, if it makes sense to you, then plunge in and go for it. If you're passionate about something, you're going to be better at it. And if you have a passion for this business, you will become pretty good at it. But if you're not passionate about it, if you just think, oh gosh, I can do this and make a bunch of money, well, that's the worst reason to go into any kind of business. Find something you're passionate about and throw yourself into it.
Well, I know we're never supposed to talk about religion or politics, but that's just not always possible. We look at the U.S. brilliance in so many areas, and I think many of us look at the U.S. choice of presidents and contenders. and a surprise that a country so rich in so many ways doesn't appear to find the best in their political candidates.
Well, I would say if you're looking for an argument, you're going to have to go someplace else. It kind of just amazes me that our country is able to do what it's able to do with the frankly very poor political leadership that we have across both aisles. And there are exceptions to the rule, but we just seem to not choose our political leaders with the same gusto that we choose our private sector leaders. And the magic of U.S. economy is capitalism, it's free enterprise, it's the private sector, and the public sector just slows us down. We could be growing a lot faster if we had better public policies.
Great, that's a nice answer. The question I perhaps should have asked you at the beginning, and I've been calling you CT since I was introduced to you, but why CT?
I was named after my grandfather. He was a wonderful gentleman. And my son is named after his father. And I'm something like CT the sixth. They call me the third because my grandfather's grandfather passed away early and he became like senior. But I'm really like CT the sixth. We're not very good at coming up with new names in my family, I guess.
But what does it stand for?
Well, that we'll wait for the next podcast.
So, C.T. Fitzpatrick, thank you for your time today. I think you have explained not just the Vulcan Value Partners proposition very clearly. I think you are also very clear in what you need to see in the companies you identify. And that doesn't always happen in the investment management industry because there's a lot of noise, there's a lot of distraction. It's easy to be drawn by lots of other things. So thank you for sharing your philosophy and your approach. I'm going to take away a couple of things which you said. One, which is for the young folks, that doing something simply for the money is not enough. And I think that that sometimes is forgotten. And patience in investing allows you to look through some of the near-term turbulence, which often jolts people out of otherwise great companies.
I agree with both of those, and thank you for highlighting them. I think maybe that's a great way to end our chat tonight on that highlight. Thank you, Simon.
CT, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. Vulcan Value Partners, LLC, is an investment advisor registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission under the Investment Advisor Act of 1940. The opinions expressed are as of date of this program and are for general informational purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. The information herein is based on sources believed to be reliable but is not guaranteed and does not purport to be a complete statement or summary of the available data. The program is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. As always, please remember, investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.